Welcome to Dialogue Out Loud, where we explore the intersections of Mormonism, current events, and scholarly thought. I'm your host, Margaret Olson Hemming, the co-editor of Dialogue, and today I'm excited to speak with Ryan Davis. Ryan is a professor of Hispanic Studies at Illinois State University and holds a PhD from Emory University. In the field of Mormon studies, his published and forthcoming work explores missionary athletes, missionary bands, and Spanish Mormon Westerns. He is currently writing a book about representations of Mormons and Mormonism in modern Spain. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So your article in this summer issue of Dialogue is called Enos Encoded, Narrative Structure in the Small Plates. When I read this essay, I was really struck by a question I think you're posing throughout, which is, what if the Book of Mormon's most powerful teachings aren't in what it says outright, but what it delays saying? I think you flip the script on how we read scripture, showing how Nephi and Enos don't just receive revelation, they shape it and they frame it, and they actually use it kind of to their own ends to claim authority. For those who are not familiar with your article and its arguments, would you please share with us your thesis and a summary of your piece?
Yeah, thank you. So, as a literary scholar, I'm interested in reading stories, right? And so my argument kind of takes place at two levels, but the most straightforward way to explain it would probably be to say, why is it that people continue reading a story when they pick it up? When we pick up the small plates, we begin with the story that Nephi tells us. And in the very first chapter of the Book of Mormon, he introduces this figure that his father has seen. But he doesn't tell us who this figure is. He mentions 12, but we don't know that these are the 12 apostles. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of questions that he opens up for us as readers. And that naturally drives us to want to continue reading so that we can kind of satisfy our desire to have knowledge about who this figure is and where he fits in the story. And so that drives us to kind of continue reading the small plates. The mystery is, in fact, resolved as this figure is first associated with the Messiah and then Christ. And today, you know, we often assume automatically that these are the same figure. But it wasn't necessarily the case it's not necessarily the case in the small plates, right? The language of Messiah gives way to the language of Christ from 1st to 2nd Nephi. Anyway, so as you're reading the story, you have a desire to answer the questions that Nephi implicitly raises. And we come to identify this figure with Christ. So that's where we get when we read from the beginning. But when we get to the end, we find this really interesting language by Jerem and Abinadab. They say that what Enos has written is sufficient, or suffices me. And so they're pointing to Enos and his experience and what he has written as somehow significant narratively. And given that, if we assume narratives to be coherent wholes, there must be some sort of relationship between the way a story starts and the way a story ends. What I set out to do in this article was to try to connect those dots. What does this figure at the beginning of the story have to do with what Jerem and Abinadab have said about Enos and his experience at the end? And so on the one hand, we have a desire to answer the questions about who this figure is. On the other hand, we have to kind of make sense with what does that figure have to do with Enos and his experience in his book.
Hmm. Okay, so you're setting apart the small plates and seeing a narrative unveiling of Christ starting at the beginning and connecting through to the end with Enos, correct? So,
yeah.
So in that case, you're treating the small plates as a coherent narrative whole, despite the fragmentary structure and the multiple authors. You know, it's sort of a running joke, but there are multiple places through the small plates in which it's just kind of a handoff. And they say, you know, here I am, nothing really happened, you know, on to the next person. So I'm kind of wondering, what theological and interpretive risks do you see in assuming coherence where the text itself seems discontinuous? And how do you weigh those risks against the insights gained by doing so?
Yeah, that is a wonderful question. And I'm fully cognizant that others will have nothing to do with the assumption that the small plates can be read as narratively coherent or a coherent whole. And I address this a little bit in the article. My point is simply, or I would respond as follows. One need not read the small plates as a coherent whole. And in fact, there are some really wonderful insights that are gained from scholars who don't. My point is to begin with a question. What happens if we do, in fact, read it as a coherent whole?
Mm-hmm.
It does seem that there are clues in the text that the small plates are understood to be this kind of this singular element.
Mm-hmm.
It may have multiple voices. In fact, it does have multiple voices. There are all sorts of kind of complications as a text that we find in it. But let's just go out on a limb here and read the small plates as if they were a coherent whole. In a certain sense, they're kind of presented to us in that way. Nephi talks about the small plates. Others in it refer to them as this coherent whole. They may well be narratively complex, but there's nothing stopping us from doing that as an exercise, a thought exercise, even if you want. And so if we do that, what kind of insights might we find? And as I lay out in the article, I think there's a really productive relationship between the way the small plates begin and the way the small plates end. In other words, there's some sort of fundamental relationship between the figure that Nephi introduces and Enos's experience at the end.
Mm-hmm.
On the one hand, Nephi, the way his narrative works, he deals a lot, at least as I present it, with questions that the reader wants to find answers to. And you have to keep reading to get those. Once we get to Enos, the mystery has been resolved. We know who this figure is that Lehi has seen. Now what happens with the text? Because we continue to read the story, it keeps going. And what I tease out in the article is that there's this evolving or this emergent Nephite messianism that connects this messianic figure with Christ. And then along comes Enos, who listens to the words that his father tells about this figure and his relationship with the house of Israel. That's what moves him into the forests. That's what drives his wrestle before the Lord, as he calls it. And he undergoes this transformative process.
Mm-hmm.
So in some sense, yes, it's very much, we're going out on a limb. We're rolling the dice, as it were. What happens if we do read it as a narrative whole? It allows us to see the things that I've suggested we can see as it relates to Enos in the small plates.
Yeah, that's great. I think it's also, as you said, Nephi seems to refer to them as a whole, and Mormon does as well, right? So,
yes.
Yeah, I think you make a strong argument there.
I would say, I mean, for what it's worth, you know, living in the 21st century, postmodern narratives regularly do this. They complicate the simplicity of narrative. They introduce a number of voices. In fact, it's not even really postmodern texts. Going back to the, you know, what many consider the first novel, Don Quixote, there are a multiplicity of voices. There are a multiplicity of genre types. That's, in a sense, related to kind of the novel genre. And, you know, it's very complicated as it relates to the Book of Mormon, given the question of historicity. You know, is this a 19th century creation? Is it based on some sort of text that predates the modern era? Right. These, of course, are all complications that have been dealt with in the scholarship. But I certainly think for readers in the 21st century who are accustomed to, you know, reading from beginning to end stories, what happens when we do that with the small plates? I do think there are things that we see that we wouldn't otherwise see if we just dig in our heels and say, there's no way that we can read this as a coherent whole.
Okay, thank you. So going back to this language you referenced a few minutes ago about the difference between Christ and Messiah, as I read the article, you are making a very compelling case that the term Christ in the small plates is not just a translation of Messiah or sort of a, you know, maybe a word choice by Joseph Smith or by the you know, whoever the author was, but a novel sort of theological development from Messiah to Christ. So what implications does this have for how Latter-day Saints or Mormons or readers of the Book of Mormon understand covenant theology and possibly also the relationship between the Old and New Testaments?
Yeah. And this is a really, really rich field for exploration. There's a lot of scholarship that is out there, but it does raise a lot of serious questions. And I'm hardly the first one that's noticed the language in the small plates. But if I might, I'll begin with kind of just a little anecdote. So I was talking to a friend at church about the Book of Mormon, and he was making this point that these prophets of old, Lehi included, had these visions, and they knew so much, right, about our what we would call theology today, more than, you know, than we recognize. They kind of had a vision maybe of things that some of us don't, you know, fully see or grasp. And we had this conversation right as, you know, at the moment when I was kind of working through these issues for myself in this article. And I didn't bring it up at the time, but I told them that's really interesting because I'm actually working on something right now where if we look just at what the text says, there are a lot of clues that suggest that there is kind of this emergent awareness of this messianic figure. Lehi never uses the term Christ, at least, again, as the text says. It's one that emerges more in Second Nephi, and it's pretty striking if you do like the word count. And other words come into play as well. The Holy One of Israel, or the Holy One, much more prominent in First Nephi and the small plates, and kind of it doesn't entirely disappear, but it does drastically disappear after the small plates. And so the question is why? Like, well, what is going on? One of the readers for my essay pointed this out and suggested, you know, you're treating these two as if they mean something different, but they're like, one is Hebrew, one is Greek. They just mean anointed one. They're interchangeable. And so when you talk about them as though they're different, it just sounds like you're talking in circles. And It's a fair criticism, right? My point is simply that I'm not the one doing that. The small plates are the ones doing that, right? There's a clear distinction between a preference for the Messiah, or terms like the Holy One of Israel in First Nephi, and later in Second Nephi, Christ. And it does seem to me that Christ, that term Christ, operates almost as a proper noun, a name. And so to get back to your question, what are the implications of that? Well, on the one hand, as you know, my friend had suggested, what exactly did these prophets of old know? What does it mean if we admit that maybe their knowledge was emerging as well? Joe Spencer has a really nice article about the question of Nephite messianism and what the Israelites in the old world would have understood about Messiah, and how Lehi may or may not have gotten into problems by referring to this as a singular person that was more well-known than maybe would have been granted at the time. So, I mean, this goes way beyond my ken. This is work for theologians and, you know, and ancient scripture historians and whatever. My point is simply that this emerges from the text itself, right? The question of who knows what, when, about whom, is really fascinating to me. Jacob, for instance, when he's talking at the temple discourse in 2 Nephi, I think it's 6 to 10, chapter 6 to 10. Mm-hmm. It's a parenthetical interruption of his own talk to point out that, oh, last night the angel told me that his name was Christ.
Hmm.
I mean, what does that mean if he interrupts what he's saying to say, hey, by the way, this is what this figure's name is? Mm-hmm. Do the people not know? And so... anyway, it's just really fascinating that the small plates really do evince this emergent Nephite messianism that identifies Christ, or, you know, Jesus as the Messiah. And it happens, you know, in the new world, far away from the old world.
Mm. Yeah. And what does it mean for Jacob that he seems to have had this revelation from an angel that perhaps affected his own views, or, you know, brought him more understanding that he's now sharing with the people. Yeah, that's really interesting.
Well, and for what it's worth, that's the discourse that I argue is what Enos is referring to when he says the words of my father, right, sank deep into my heart. That's what I argue he's referring to. Other scholars have suggested other textual sources, but I think he talks about the joy of the saints, Jacob does, and that's what is sitting or resting, as it were, on Enos's heart, weighing on his heart, and that's what drives him to the forests. That's what drives him to pray, this idea of joy and saints. And if you go back to Jacob's discourse, at the center of all of that is this redemptive figure. It's this Holy One of Israel that, again, is tied to the Messiah that Lehi sees, to Christ that Nephi talks so much about. It's all kind of comes together in this one figure who binds the house of Israel, right? Which Enos, I mean, he never knew his homeland,
mm-hmm.
Right? He never knew this place that his parents or his grandparents or whomever would have talked about. And so he belongs to this covenant people. He belongs to this chosen people. But where does he fit in? Where does he fit in as someone who's growing up in, you know, the wilderness, is what Jacob talked about, right? And so I think this figure is really at the heart of Enos's experience.
Okay, so it seems like you're arguing that both characters in the Book of Mormon, including prophets, and readers of the Book of Mormon go through a kind of conversion process, that their understanding of Christ does not come all at once and is not all the same, but comes in sort of these stages and then is reflected in the language of how they refer to Christ. Was that something you discovered as you wrote these essays, or was it a framework you started with? How did you come to this essay?
I think it must have, certainly it would have emerged as I'm reading this, right? As I'm trying to make sense of how can we read the small plates as a coherent whole, a coherent textual whole. If we're going to do that, what does that look like? I must have noticed that Nephi presents implicitly all these questions. And as the Nephites themselves, or the Lehites initially, and then maybe later the Nephites, as they experience this emergent understanding of messianism, we're kind of accompanying them as we read the story, if that makes sense, right? So as they're growing in their knowledge of this messianic figure, of the identity of this mysterious figure that Lehi sees, we too are almost narratively along for the ride, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. There's a line in the essay where I talk about how the small plates are meta, right? So
right.
There's like this parallel experience, right?
Right. And I guess I'm wondering how much of that do you think is intentional with an overall structure of the plates, and how much of it is this is just the story that evolves as people come to know, get further revelation?
Yeah, and no doubt the answer to that question, I would imagine, would depend on any number of assumptions you might make as a reader. Mm-hmm. So if you accept that Nephi and Lehi were historical figures, right, that lived a long time ago, that were a people that were becoming a Christian people long before Christ ever came, then I think you read the text one way, right? If not, and it's, you know, if you kind of take the Book of Mormon as simply a modern construct, then I think you read it a different way. And no doubt between those two poles, there's an infinite number of ways that one could read that, right? All I can say is that if you take the text at, and maybe this is where people would have problems. I was about to say, if you take the text at face value, right? If you just take what the text tells you, and again, people would say, well, hold on, already we've got problems. What do you mean when you say the text, right? Joseph claimed it, you know, was a translation from these plates or whatever. All we have access to, at least, is what we call the Book of Mormon today. And when we read that, there are plenty of textual clues, right, that would suggest that there was a very intentional editorial hand, probably. More than one editorial hands, no doubt. And so on the one hand, yeah, I do think there's very much intentionality. Some of the impact of what is written, though, is, I think, a function of language itself. And some of that will perhaps be reflective of what the writers would have wanted or would have tried or were trying to say.
Okay. Yeah, that's fair. I really appreciate a literary reading of scripture. You are definitely employing that approach. But I'm wondering if some readers would wonder if digging into the storytelling structure of scripture feels a little risky. And what would you say to people who are nervous about reading the Book of Mormon this way? Or why does it matter to look at how the story is told and not just what words are on the page?
Yeah. Oh, so many ways to answer this. It's such a good question. I think I point out at one point in the article that modern readers, but you know, by which I mean any of us who are alive today, almost by default, I would be willing to assume once we start reading the Book of Mormon, anytime we hear Messiah, we automatically think of Jesus. When we read Christ, we automatically think of Jesus, right? We read it as Christians, right, who are living at a time when the world has seen 2,000 years of Christianity, right? Or if you're of this particular persuasion and you believe, you know, that Jesus was the Christ, you know, from the foundation of the world, then Christianity has been around since the beginning, right? Not just the meridian of time, as the scriptures talk about it. And so it's, on the one hand, I understand that people are going to read it through that lens. At least for me, one of the things that I got out of this was a greater appreciation for the people, Lehi, his family, who were asked to do some really, really hard things, right, with limited amount of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't bother me in the least if Lehi didn't have maybe a complete understanding or a full vision, right? I think there's something quite humanizing about recognizing that all of us grow, right, in our knowledge. And I think it renders kind of a three-dimensionality to them as people, right? I don't have to have all the right answers to all of the questions before I go through the messy work of living life. And I think that goes for reading scriptures as well, right? I mean, if I'm also tempted to say that, you know, if we don't think the Book of Mormon can hold its own, then we've kind of given away part of the game, as it were. I mean, if those in the faith believe it to be, you know, divine, then I have no problems that it can withstand all of the readings that we could throw its way, right? And not only that, I think it's a text that the more you read it, including literarily, the more it gives you. And I mean, it's quite fascinating. I've just grown immensely in my appreciation for it, because of how much it rewards reading and rereading and rereading, and wrestling with it immensely, right? And looking at it through this lens or that lens.
Yeah. Okay, last question. So if the narrative structure is not just decorative, but does theological work, I know this is beyond sort of the container of your essay, but I'm curious what your thoughts are on it. If the narrative structure is doing theological work, then what implications does that have for our own stories and how we record them?
Yeah. Oh, boy. So, I mean, I think on the one hand, you know, I've been around academia long enough to have heard this idea that, you know, stories are nice decorative pieces of life, but they don't do a lot of heavy lifting when it comes to, you know, knowledge or an understanding of the way, you know, the universe works. And I just don't buy that anymore. I think narrative, at least, and one could talk about poetry and drama in other ways, right? But just thinking about narrative itself, I think I just don't know how one makes sense of the world without coming at it in some ways narratively.
Mm-hmm.
I know others may disagree, but I just don't see how you can get past that. And so on the one hand, narrative is a tool that we have to make sense of our lives, to make sense of the world, to make sense of essentially everything that we see. And So that's the first part of the answer. The second part is, I mean, how do you contain divinity in the vessel of language, or the vessel, any vessel that we have as humans, right? In all of our limitations. I don't know how you can, right? And yet it's a tool that we have, but at least for me, it's always gesturing me beyond. And so when I read the scriptures, I value immensely the formal elements, right? I think it matters immensely how stories are told. But it's always kind of a double-edged sword, right? The story matters, the way it's told matters, but there's always something else, right? There's always a remainder that's left over about the sacred, about the divine. And so we go through life with these imperfect tools, but incredibly rich tools. And that's what I would say.
Yeah. It certainly speaks to the value of having a variety of perspectives that you're talking about, right? This variety of understandings. The more stories we hear, the more complete the picture becomes.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on Dialogue Out Loud today. I appreciate you being here. And thanks to listeners for being part of this conversation about the narrative theology of the Book of Mormon, where meaning unfolds slowly and authority is built through story. Don't forget to subscribe to Dialogue Out Loud, leave a review, and share this episode with someone who's ready to read the Book of Mormon with fresh eyes. You can read Ryan Davis's entire article for free at dialoguejournal.com. I'm Margaret Olson Hemming. Thank you for listening.
Greetings. My name is Rebecca DeSchweinitz, and I'm thrilled to serve as a board member at the Dialogue Foundation and as one of the hosts of Dialogue Gospel Study. In each episode, which we record live the second and fourth Sunday of every month, we welcome esteemed speakers from a variety of backgrounds to share their insights and perspectives on the Come Follow Me lessons. Our aim is to spark meaningful conversations about the scriptures, to connect them to our personal experiences and to our understandings and explorations of the gospel. To stay in the loop with our upcoming lessons and this opportunity to engage with Mormon thought, culture, and belief, be sure to visit dialoguejournal.com and sign up for our newsletter. By doing so, you'll receive updates and timely links to join our live stream lessons. Additionally, you can catch up on our past guests and episodes by subscribing to Dialogue Journal on YouTube, Facebook, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Dialogue Podcast Network.